Today on Focus, we're taking your questions on personal finance. And retirement is on the minds of our guests, Chartered Financial Analyst Kevin Wasby and U of I Extension Educator Kathy Sweetler. Illinois' new pension reform law gives state employees the option of a defined contribution plan similar to a 401k, an option that's on the rise with many employers. But when is a defined contribution plan the right choice for retirement? And how late in life can you begin one and get a good return? I'm Jim Meadows. That's one of the topics our guests will discuss today. And your personal finance questions are welcome. That's today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is a show for answering your personal finance questions, the last one for 2013. Joining me today is Kevin Wasby, Chartered Financial Analyst, also a lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Business, where I guess finals have just finished.
Are finishing today, Jim.
Okay. And Kathy Sweetler is a consumer economics educator with the University of Illinois Extension's office in Champaign. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you very much.
And do you have questions about investing, saving, personal finances in general? Now is the time to contact us at our toll-free number. It's 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Well, in terms of financial matters, one of the things that people have been talking about over the past few weeks is pension reform for state employees in Illinois. Governor Quinn signed a pension reform law a few weeks ago. It's expected to go right into court, and it will and be in there for who knows how long and what shape it'll be when it comes out. We don't know. But we expect something to come out of it eventually. Kevin, I understand you've read the entire bill that was passed by the General Assembly and signed by the governor. And what can you make out of it?
You're right, Jim. I've read it twice, actually. And the amount that I've gotten out of it is minimal. It's rather confusing, as much legislation happens to be. But some of the more widely discussed items are, I would say, the easier to understand. Interestingly enough, I know at least three people that have called either their representative's office or the State University Retirement System, SERS, to ask for clarification from it, and they get the same answer that I've just given. We're not really sure yet.
It sounds like this is the sort of topic you shouldn't make a hasty decision in relation to.
I think, at least in my opinion, what's going on now or the amount that is unknown at this point is so much greater than the amount that is known that making decisions based on what is known is probably not a good thing to do if you can avoid it.
Well, I know some of the basics, which are at least in the laws that was passed, include modifying and pulling back on the cost of living allowance increases on the level of a pension, but also reducing the amount that state employees pay into the pension system. At the same time, I understand there is an option in there to for state employees, not just in SERS, the State University Retirement System, where I understand it already existed, but in other state pension funds, to go from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan. And that's something I wanted to talk about a little bit more, because that sort of transition is really happening all over the place, not in this particular group of retirees.
That's correct. We've been seeing this trend from moving from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan happening across the country, really, in the last 20 years, and especially in, you know, private industry. So it's not new in the sense of a trend in our country, but now we're really kind of has drawn our attention to it locally. A defined benefit plan is sort of what we think of as our grandfather's pension plan. It's the type where you went to work for a particular company. You probably worked there all your life. When you retired, you received a check monthly, and it would have been calculated based on a formula on the number of years you worked, your salary, and, you know, kind of calculated through there. And you would, you're sort of, this is the amount you were given. And the risk and the responsibility was all on the employer. The employee just put in the time. The defined contribution plan has changed. It has shifted the responsibility of that risk to the employee. So you make, depending on the particular plan from the particular company or that you're working with, both the employer and or the employee can make contributions into it. But the amount you have when you retire depends on how it's invested and how well those investments do, as well as the cost of the plan. And so you don't, there is no simple formula for that where you can say, if I retire at 65, I will have this amount of money.
And there's no minimal guarantee, is there?
No, it's like having an investment portfolio that you and your employer have set up. And again, depending on who you work for, you have different investment options within that plan. So we can't even say that they're all the same across different companies, across different universities or government. Plans.
Some of these plans are, is this a generalized, you know, an accurate generalization? Do they give the employee more flexibility? I mean, they could choose not to do this at all, or they could choose to do one thing or another within, you know, with, as far as the investment choices are concerned.
That's a good question, Jim, and it varies. I'd like to back up just a moment, though, because the two words that generalize what the type of plan is are really, really good literal words. So in other words, a defined contribution plan says how much money is regularly put aside for the purpose of retirement. A defined benefit plan says just the opposite. At retirement, how much benefit will you receive? And the difference between them can really be thought of much more clearly if you think of those words as literally as I just explained them. Now, to your question about a defined contribution plan, many defined contribution plans in industry that have been around 30, 40 years really don't have an element of participation as it relates to the employee's choice for any company money. So in other words, if the company partially contributes to the plan, then the employee will receive those contributions in their specific individual account, period, end of story. That can be conditioned on some amount of vesting, which means to say a tie to how long the employee works at the firm. They might have to work there a full year before they're eligible to get a part of the company contribution for that year. But once that's met, there's little, how should we say, election on the part of an employee as to getting a benefit from the employer's contribution. The voluntary part is the part that we all refer to as a 401k plan, again, in private industry. And that is how much the employee elects to defer from their own compensation into this retirement plan. And that's where lots of choices come up, not only in terms of how much, but in terms of where the money is invested, how often they can change it, the kinds of investment considerations that Kathy mentioned already, as we think of it literally as an investment portfolio where we have an active voice.
If you have a choice, if you're given a choice between a defined benefit and defined contribution, what sort of things should you think about in trying to make a decision?
Well, that's an excellent question. You would want, I mean, one of the first things, of course, would be if you're looking at a defined benefit plan is you would love to know just how financially savvy that company will be, an organization, you know, 50 to 60 years later when you want the money. It's because you're depending on that organization, that company, to provide that benefit. And so that would be one question. Then sometimes that's clear and sometimes that's not so clear.
Do sometimes companies, I mean, do they invest it themselves or do they work with financial investment firms to do the investing for them?
Well, in a defined benefit plan, most of the time there's going to be a trust deed arrangement and an investment advisory firm or even an investment firm itself that's going to make the decisions about what investments are held. Again, there's a board of trustees for all of the government plans that oversee professional investment advisors who are hired and fired based on the managers doing what they've purported to do and how well they've done it. In a defined contribution plan, again, all of that shifts back onto the employee. The individual participant will be making those kinds of decisions within a menu of allowable options.
Well, I'm just wondering, if you're making a choice between one or the other, and you're, you know, just being the employee there, I don't know what sort of, what you, in what way you're able to look at the books or how you analyze them. How do you make the decision as to how good a job your employer is doing in investing with the defined contribution plan, and then go from that from deciding which one to take?
Well, I think in a defined contribution plan, it really gets down to the employer has made an arrangement with a particular trustee, custodian, investment group. So, for instance, if the employer has initiated this plan and the investment options available to the employees through it are constricted to certain investment mutual funds, insurance policies, or the like, the easiest way to begin is to say not how well they've done from an investment rate of return, but to look at the overall cost of those investment options. So in other words, what type of management fees, what type of overhead, so on and so forth, cuts in over a long period of time, cuts in significantly to what kind of actual growth in value there is to the fund for the employee. So bottom line is if you begin looking at a 401k plan at your employer, a 403b plan at your not-for-profit or educational employer, and start to say, well, what's working well, start at the top and say, where am I getting the most cost-efficient means of investing?
I would definitely agree with that. That was kind of the direction I was going, is sometimes given your options, you need to look at which is the best option because you just have a fixed choice. You're not going to be able to say, you know, well, I'm picking from all these hundreds of different companies' options. It's just where you're working. And so looking at the costs of those defined contribution plans, looking at your choices within them. Sometimes you have better choices. Sometimes you don't have good choices. Sometimes you may look at it and say, I really don't like that choice. Therefore, I'm going to switch the other way. And a lot of people don't have a choice between one or the other. They have what their company provides.
Well, we're going to go to the phones now and take a couple of calls. If you would like to talk to our personal finance experts, the phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email your question at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. On line four, Tom and Terre Haute, good morning. You're on Focus.
Out of curiosity, if you have a 401k plan that you have had for many, many years, and you have an employee that was vested in it, and he withdrew his percent of it, and did not show up for work or went to another job for 3 or 4 years, and then you went back and, or, you know, during all this period of time, remained investing in your 401k plan as an employer, do you also have to invest for the employee since the employee does not invest himself?
Let me try to get a little clearer on that. We have a situation where an employee who was an active participant in a 401k plan leaves the employer.
Correct.
And after some period of time, they never withdraw their balance in the plan. Is that true?
No, he withdrew his balance from the plan many years ago.
Okay.
And then he came back about 3 or 4 years later with zero value in the 401k plan. Now, does the employer have to start up another, you know, 401k employee plan for him?
No, I mean, when a participant leaves the employer's, employ, yes. when they no longer work for them, if they exercise their prerogative to withdraw funds, they're no longer a participant. If they come back into the employ of the company, then they're just like any other new employee. In other words, if there's still an active plan, then if there's a 1 year of service requirement before they're eligible to participate, then they jump right back at the starting point.
Okay.
There's nothing going on the responsibility of the employer during that time the employee was not there after they took their distribution. If the distribution was left in the plan, then the employer would literally have the responsibility to contact them to inform them of their options, and then within the plan language there would be the default: what happens if the employee never gets back in touch with them? How is the money held on their behalf? But it's not a they don't lose it. But your circumstance shortcuts all of that because you've just said the person took their distribution at the time of leaving employ.
Yes, and he paid his penalty, I assume, to the government and whatever. So I didn't know. I was just curious if I had to reinstate him in the 401k plan.
No, unless they come back into your employ within 1 year of leaving, that the fact that they've received distribution and been gone the length of time that you're mentioning really puts them back at the starting point.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Well, thank you very much for calling. Let's go ahead and take another call. Danny in Urbana on line one. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Two quick points. One is the situation is very different between private sector employees and public sector employees in Illinois, so that in the private sector, if one chooses a 401k, one always has Social Security as the baseline. So whatever you've contributed, you're going to have Social Security. And if you really make big mistakes in your 401k, you've got something to fall back on. What the state offered 15 years ago when the stock market was roaring along in the late 90s, an option to convert into 401k. And the problem there is that state employees don't contribute to Social Security. So that 401k is what you've got. And if someone opted to retire, let's say in 2008 when the stock market tanked, the rules were that within, I think, 3 months after retirement, you have to take the value of the 401k and buy an annuity. So then it mimics a defined benefit, so you've got a benefit for the rest of your life. So you might have lost 45% of your portfolio with the stock market crash and be in a situation where you're locked into that lower value, the annuity that you could have bought in 2008 for the rest of your life. Or if you were approaching retirement and you wanted to retire, you had to ride it out until the stock market came back. So I think the sorts of risk that one takes makes a big difference whether you're a public sector employee in Illinois, the state's not paying into Social Security, you've got no fallback position, and you also take a big risk when you turn the 401k into an annuity.
I agree with you. You've brought up a very significant distinction. When we talk about state employees, whether we're university employees or state workers in Springfield in the Capitol building, so on, and so, the neat thing that you've brought up, the great distinction, is one of the reasons why people have a defined benefit plan provided through a state retirement system, one of the five offered, is because as a state employee, you are not paying into, and neither is your employer, the state, you're not paying into the Social Security system. So, you know, Social Security is never meant, was never meant to be the entirety of retirement income, but it was certainly meant to be a safety net level of income, which in good logic perfectly applied could have been said about the state's retirement systems as defined benefit plans. And I say that with two elements that need some emphasis. The first is a base level subsistence type of plan, not a Cadillac type of enrichment scheme. The second thing is, it is the security of a known fixed amount in the future. That was the purpose behind Social Security. And again, in a pure application of a state retirement system, that should be a defined benefits reason for being there, because there is no Social Security. So I admire what you've just said. You've hit the nail on the head of one of the important things that need to be considered when a person talks about private sector versus state of Illinois employee-employer relationships.
If I can make one more quick point, the question is, why did the state opt out of the Social Security when they did in the 1950s? The reason they gave at the time was, we want to do enhanced benefits. We want it to be more than Social Security.
Well,
and so they got a waiver based upon, if they met minimum requirements, they wouldn't have to contribute to Social Security. What they've done in the recent reform is now scale it back, where arguably for many people it doesn't match Social Security, and by taking away the cost of living, or at least redefining the calculation. One of the questions that I think the courts are going to have to sort out is whether this revision actually violates the 1957 agreement when Illinois opted out. But Illinois did not intend to simply duplicate Social Security. They offered it to their employees as, we're going to do more than Social Security, and now they seem to be wanting to back away from that.
Well, and again, another excellent point. You've brought up the intention in 1957. It reminds me at this time of year of a favorite saying of mine: if ifs and buts were candies and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas. The sad fact of the matter is those pure intentions in 1957 were nowhere ever completely executed upon. So imagine a situation where the state of Illinois did have employees pay through and into the Social Security system. If 1957's law was never enacted, imagine that system where the state legislature never made their contribution to the employee wage at Social Security.
Well, what happens with the federal system is, if an employer misses a quarterly payment, the feds come with handcuffs to walk you off to a place of confinement.
My point exactly.
And the state of Illinois, our politicians don't acknowledge that.
That does seem to be the case, and that'll be an interesting question to see is what a court says about this whole thing in the months to come. Danny, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
It is 10:28, and that is a question. I thought that the fact that the state employee pensions take the place of Social Security had something to do with an early feature of the Social Security law. I understood that in its very earliest days, it didn't cover government employees, including state employees, and it was only in later years that it was that the law was revised to allow them to come into the system. And I thought maybe Illinois was just sort of a throwback as far as that was concerned.
Well, again, I mean, Kathy brought up something early in our discussion today that's very important. The defined benefit plans in the private sector are really something that goes back hundreds of years ago in England. They were meant to be a way for reward of long service. They were meant to be a private enterprise-funded mechanism to, how should we say, provide a subsistence level of income to retired individuals from the private sector. Governments usually had their own plan that were very similarly mimicking those. And in the early days of Social Security, Remember, Social Security was a federal law. It was a law that was, how should we say, a part of a process where federal governments, the federal government was assuming more power and authority over states, but it was also in an era where states' rights were much stronger than they are perhaps even today. The bottom line is many state employers had their own, many municipal employers had their own defined benefit plans even before Social Security.
Well, we're going to, I think, take another call in just a moment on this subject. But first, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more talk about financial, personal finance matters with Kevin Wasby and with Kathy Sweetler here on Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and the topic is personal finance, from pensions to investments. My guests are U of I College of Business lecturer Kevin Wasby and U of I Extension Home Ec educator Kathy Sweetler, and they're ready to answer your personal finance questions. The phone number is 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580, and the phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. On line two, David from Urbana is on the line. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes. Another issue that seems to be coming up is a number of mostly very rich men are pointing to what they see as the advantages of retirement plans that feature 401(k)s or something of the sort without any defined benefit. And there's a real flaw to this thinking. With defined benefit, you're using actuarial statistics to decide how much can be paid out of the fund. And you can simply define that as all of the savings can be paid out by the average lifespan. But if you're doing this as an individual with a saving program, 401 or whatever, you can't figure it that way. You have to figure that you might possibly live to be 95, 100, 105, and therefore you can only withdraw probably about 4%, so that the remaining earnings will be sufficient to keep up with cost of living and inflation. And therefore, to get $40,000 a year, say, for your living expenses, you'd need at least $1 million in savings, which would be very difficult for the average person to accumulate. I don't know what the average savings is at present, but as I understand it, it's well below $100,000 at retirement.
Well, you've brought up what I think is a very important distinction between the goals, objectives, and what I would say are reasonable expectations that you'd put behind two different plans. They are very different because they have very different objectives. And they have very, very different resulting outcomes. If we're looking for a safety net of income approach, a defined benefit plan certainly is that approach that makes the most sense. For an employee who has Social Security coverage, that makes sense to say that that's the safety net. And on top of that is private investment on their own, whether it's through a 401k, an IRA, or even independent of a retirement account, just literally the ability to spend less money than they make and have savings, okay? That's always going to be a component, I think. I think what we're seeing politically is the cost of ignoring that has brought us to the result where now we have the bitter medicine to take and more likely realize that the burden on individuals to save for their future will be more visible. This is never changed. The burden for an individual to have a higher standard of living at retirement has always been predominantly on their shoulders. It's just now more obvious, more visible.
And I think that we have to realize, too, that there's a lot of things that are putting pressure on the system that are just sort of a factor in our society. And one is that people are living longer. And not only are people living longer, people still want to retire at about, to be honest, we want to retire younger than what we had seen historically. So we're looking at people working maybe 30 to some years and then expecting to retire for 30 some years or more. And so in that relatively short time period of working, which may not seem so short day to day, but you know, from a lifetime perspective, you're looking at not only supporting your day to day life, but really saving enough and investing enough to support decades of retirement. And that is what is making all of this so difficult.
And that's the challenge, especially if you end up not fitting the actuarial table, I guess.
Well, the other element about a defined benefit plan is the insurance nature of it. Regardless of the benefit that I earn at time of retirement, if I'm blessed with a lifespan that brings me to be 103 years old, that annuity payment continues, even if it exhausts the amount of money that I put in myself, that my employer put in for me, and the investment earnings over the years happen to build a balance. Again, that's an insurance feature, that's an insurance condition built into a defined benefit plan that, again, through an actuarial application of mathematics, balances off those people who unfortunately meet an untimely demise and never live long enough to withdraw the amount of money that went in either from them, their employer, and the earnings on it. Again, a defined contribution plan never had that element built into it. The defined benefit plan by design did.
I want to thank David for his call. We have another caller here on line 4, Ken from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually had one simple question and one that probably requires a little more explanation. My wife and I are both state employees, and when we're calculating our target percentage for retirement savings, you know, how much we're putting away, how do you suggest we include our pension contributions in that percentage? And then my second question is, we just had our first child this year, and we are looking at into college savings, we're looking at 529 accounts. I've also seen some discussion on the internet about how it's a much better idea to focus on your retirement savings, because you can get college loans, but you can't get loans for retirement. So I just would like you to kind of discuss that and what suggestions you offer to people who are looking for college savings for their children. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And do you want to start with the college saving questions? This actually dovetails with some things we were discussing before we went on air in terms of when to save for what in the, over the course of your life.
I think that's an excellent question, and I really congratulate you for doing the hard work about thinking about different goals and how to save for those different goals while you're still young or relatively young, and that is a huge challenge. There's a lot to be said for the fact that there's different ways to fund college, and really nobody else is too interested in funding your retirement. And so making sure that you have that retirement savings and investing going on from while you're young in your 20s all the way through, I think, is an excellent goal. And when maybe you don't achieve it every year, but keep working towards that and doing it as much as you can. What you're looking at when you're looking at some of these different choices is you may want to look at what is the tax savings that you actually get. What's the tax advantage of these different plans? And depending on your income, that may be important and that may not be as important. And so that is one way to kind of look at the bang that you're going to get out of that dollar, which direction you want to send it. The other thing to keep in mind is that People work by sometimes best by kind of mental accounting, where we have different categories and boxes for our savings, and that can motivate us in a way that even when we take into all the economic realities, that motivation is huge. And so if it works for you to be thinking about this, like, I want to save this much for my child now, and I also want to save this much for retirement, I would encourage that, because that may help you beyond in a large way. One other thing I did want to mention is that 529 plans can definitely be an advantage for you. Remember that you're not limited just to plans in Illinois, that you can compare rates of returns and costs across 529 plans in other states, although you give up the state advantage on the taxes here. But again, depending on your state, your income tax level, that may or may not be important to you.
And can you address our caller's first question about, I think, factoring pension contributions into their budgeting?
That's a good question. I would say that I would factor it in, but I wouldn't factor it in with simple additional, simple arithmetic. In other words, as state employees, I would have to ask further questions and say, well, are those contributions going into defined benefit, or are they going into a defined contribution plan? And the reason I try to separate that is to say a defined benefit plan that you're hopefully and will receive benefit from at retirement is more like a fixed income investment, and an allocation decision then goes to say, okay, fine, how am I investing my retirement deferrals? And that part of it then gets us into saying, well, okay, fine, consider that part that's going to a defined benefit plan as being a fixed income component. Now we're going to say the remainder of what your target savings for retirement percentage of income is going to be allocated a little bit differently. That's a good starting point. So again, without using up the rest of our time to give a specific example, I would say that that's another facet to answer before we get into what steps are next.
We are talking about our personal finance and taking your personal finance questions on Focus today. Still time for your calls and your questions. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Kathy Sweetler and Kevin Wasby are here to answer your questions. One thing I wanted to ask about was something that the Federal Reserve did this week, or at least they announced that they're going to do, and that's something which I guess everybody knew was coming sooner or later once it was decided that the economy is actually improving and getting ready to go ahead on its own. And that's really really questions about how much money the Fed pumps into the economy. They're going to start pumping a little less from, I think it was $85 billion, was it $85 billion a month? To just $75 billion, hardly anything at all. And but it is a change, and it's the first change in a while. What does that mean, and what does that mean for investors?
That's a great question, Jim. I think it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So let me try to make it as general or universal as I can. For the past almost 5 years, the economy has been struggling to recover from a pretty stiff recession. The Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, like the central banks of many nations, have been trying to put policy in place to stimulate the economy to come back into being able to grow on its own and, how should we say, create more jobs, raise levels of income, do all of the things that growth in the economy is good for us. Bottom line is the most recent measure they've used to do that has been called quantitative easing. It is a third iteration of plans that they've used, again, now almost 5 years. And the most recent iteration of it has had them buying from the open marketplace $85 billion worth of government securities. That was split $45 billion each month in U.S. Treasury bonds and notes, and $40 billion each month in U.S. backed mortgage-backed securities. So Ginnie Mae's, Fannie Mae's, Freddie Mac's, all of the government mortgage-backed pass-through certificates. The reason they were doing that was not to, quote-unquote, pump money into the economy, but more so to lower interest rates. Lower interest rates lower the cost of doing everything you and I can imagine, including living every day, including buying and being the consumers that 80%, 75% of our economy is basically based on. So the goal has been and been very successful in bringing not only short-term interest rates lower, but long-term interest rates. They feel, with Wednesday's announcement from the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee, they feel the economy is showing enough signs of, how should we say, improvement, such that it's warranted to begin, and the word that was used back in May when this was first introduced as a potential was taper. So they believe that the economy has shown enough signs of coming back to a sustainable level of growth that they can begin to taper these purchases. What that will mean to the average person is, as we've already seen, is interest rates will slowly begin to rise.
Okay, and for interest rates, meaning that is something, I guess, welcome if you are saving.
Exactly. We've had 5 years of financial repression for people that have had money in savings instruments. So whether it's a, you know, U.S. Treasury bill note or bond, a bank certificate of deposit, or any other safe type haven for money, we all know that interest rates are punitively low for those savers. So that's the flip side of lowering interest rates in an attempt to stimulate an economy to move forward because borrowing costs are low. And again, for savers, I mean, at least we're seeing the turn around a corner and hopefully an ability to get a rate of return that is a little bit more in keeping with long-term safe money rates of return.
For borrowers, though, it will be a little more complicated.
Well, not complicated, but it will be more reflective of what a normal market condition for cost of funds is.
As an investor, how does that affect what you may or may not want to do?
Well, in my opinion, it really doesn't affect what a person should do or changes what they do. Again, that's based on a belief that a person ought to have a pretty well-diversified portfolio, not try to react to news because, in my opinion, most of the time the news is already incorporated in the marketplace. It gets me back to some of the shows that we've had over the past year or two where I've been cautioning people not to chase yields. In other words, you're sick of seeing how low the rate of return on a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year CD is. Do not pull your money out. Do not go out and buy a long-term bond mutual fund that is comprised of lower quality, what most people call junk bonds, just because it has a higher yield. And the reason is now becoming evident. When interest rates go up, the value of those bonds are the ones that go down the most.
Do you think that we can see, of course, we don't know what will happen month to month as far as the Fed reading this, but as they start putting a little less money in and interest rates possibly start to go up, that this could affect the inflation rate?
Well, if we were to look at it from just a broad economic outlook or policy point of view, you'd say that one of the reasons why they're not going to be buying as many securities and one of the reasons why they feel they don't need to have an artificial hand putting interest rates as low as they've been is because they're trying to be a little proactive in keeping inflation, which has been very low, from becoming a burden of rising in the future. So there's an element of saying, well, we don't want to overstimulate. We don't want inflation to become a burden. What we have been concerned about is the risk of deflation, and we feel like we're getting a little bit of a handle on that from being such a bigger risk.
This is our home finance edition of Focus here with Kevin Waspy and Kathy Sweetler. Kathy, I wanted to ask you, because I had seen your writing on the subject, the recent tornadoes that hit Gifford and so many other parts of the state remind us of the need for good home insurance coverage. And this is the sort of thing that doesn't happen to most people, but you just never know who it's going to happen to. And I understand you've been, as a extension educator, been hearing from people who've all of a sudden been looking perhaps at that home insurance policy they hadn't paid much attention to before now.
And I think, you know, that this is kind of just a timely time to remind people that we always need to be reviewing insurance policies, including home insurance policies, on a regular basis. Once a year would be ideal. Our homes, when we talk about, you know, preparing for a financially secure retirement, we talk about pension plans, we talk about individual investments, and we talk about real assets that we have that can help us later on. And for a lot of people, their home is one of those real big pieces of their retirement portfolio. What we want to do is make sure we've protected it. And one of the big concerns that I'm hearing from people is, what's the difference between replacement cost insurance versus market value or cash value? And so what some people, when you go to get those policies, it can be very confusing, all these different options. And what we're looking at is, if your house is destroyed and you're trying to replace, and not even just destroyed, but let's say something is stolen from you, or you have a small fire and you lose, you know, living room furniture. When you go to replace that, if you have replacement costs, if you had a sofa, you get to go out and buy a sofa at current value, you know, current market rates when you go out to the store, whatever it costs. But if you have cash value, there's depreciation that takes into account. So if you bought that sofa, oh my gosh, it's been a few years, maybe 8, 10 years. It doesn't have the value that a new one would have, or what you had when you bought it.
I take it that a replacement cost, a policy with replacement cost, may cost more than a...
Of course.
So that's just something that you have to weigh.
You have to weigh that. But we also have to keep track of the fact that, you know, building costs go up as well. And so there's lots and lots of variables to think about, and how much do you want to put into your home insurance costs. But it's there to protect your asset. You want to make sure that the policy you have suits you and is protecting your asset at its value today and not what it was maybe 10 years ago. And time goes by fast. We forget how long it's been since we looked at our policy. So this is your little nagging voice saying, maybe I should pull out that policy and check it out today.
Well, and there's another interesting twist here, too. And if we think back 7, 8, 10 years ago, when everybody was so excited about the value of their house rising 20% every year, there was actually an incentive, or at least a perceived incentive, for people to switch into a market value policy, because they looked at it and said, well, a cost of replacing my house, literally rebuilding it on this lot, is not going to be reflective of the fact that the market value of my house is now so much higher because of where it's located, because of the amenities, because of. Bottom line is, I think they mixed the elements and mix them incorrectly. And those elements are insurance versus speculation. When a person wants insurance, they want security. And a replacement value policy for something as large as the value of most people's estate is, as your house that you live in, the replacement is the risk. You need a place to live. And the replacement of that, when it's damaged, whether it's damaged in its entirety, totaled, or damaged, severely or even moderately, you've got to have the insurance in place that's going to replace the damages. The market value insurance, again, 7, 8 years ago, when everybody thought that the value of a house was always going to go up 20% a year, was literally kidding themselves. I mean, you were looking at the ability to speculate on the unfortunate possibility that there's damage or loss to your house, but gee, you'll get a bonus payment because, gee, these prices are just rising to the moon. It's silly.
Okay, so you just have to keep your eyes open. You have to you have to ask questions until you understand what's going on, it sounds like.
Definitely. You should definitely always know what the terms mean whenever you sign a contract or buy a policy. And I think if you have any questions, you need to make sure you're getting those questions answered, whether from your insurance agent or from asking another financial professional or doing research yourself. It's your responsibility to understand what you're buying.
And can your extension be of any help?
But of course, you can always give us a call at 217-333-7672, and I'm happy to try to answer any questions or point you to resources related to it.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have on this personal finance edition of Focus. Thanks to my guest, Kathy Sweetland, consumer economics educator with the U of I's Extension Office in Champaign. And thanks also to chartered financial analyst Kevin Waspy, who also lectures at the U of I. Thanks to everyone who called or emailed questions. Our apologies to anyone who didn't make it to the air on today's program. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. We'll be on a little bit of a hiatus for the Christmas week next week. On Monday, we have an archive program with historian Bill Kemp, who writes the Page From Our Past column for the Pantograph, presenting little-known facts about the history of Bloomington Normal, everything from Adlai Stevenson to Vic and Sade. Then on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, in this time slot, you'll hear Tinsel Tales, featuring Christmas stories from the NPR archives. On Thursday, in this time slot, an all-new edition of A Season's Griot, a celebration of Kwanzaa with storyteller Madafo Lloyd-Wilson. And Focus returns on Friday with another archive program looking at the field of personality testing and how it might have been used in hiring you. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10, except, of course, for next week. There's a replay at 8 p.m., and you can hear us over the air on AM 580 online at will.illinois.edu/focus. This is Focus on WYLL.